So I'm very interested in you and your work because I've been following you on Facebook for a little while. I've seen you've written these amazing books, and a lot of the subjects of your books and your blogs stray into territory that I'm curious about. And I was very curious because you've done a lot of work on megaliths. What are the different types of megaliths? I've seen terms like dolmens, cromlechs, menhirs, etc., but I
Yes.
don't know what they are. I don't know who made them and why.
Well, megalith, I mean, it literally means large single structure. It wasn't a term that was really used until Jean Michel in the 70s really pushed the idea of us thinking about megaliths in the wider consciousness. You know, what do they mean? And he was off on his theories of the perpetual choirs, etc., and things. But prior to him, we had William Stukeley and John Aubrey, who were antiquarians during the 1700s, and sorry, Aubrey, late 1600s, but who wanted to go around and catalogue all our megaliths. Now, they had some odd ideas as well. They were Roman, they were Celtic, they were this or that. I mean, Stukeley even put a sort of Christian context on some of them. But that's where we get the sort of the megalith idea from. You know, first these two fellas, and then sort of Jean Michel revived the idea in the 70s. The different types, well, as time wears on, and the sort of the ravages of human activity as well, because people pulled these sites apart throughout history, you can have stones, and you would just call it a megalith or a standing stone or a menhir. We use a lot of old Gaulish words, old sort of Celtic French words, dolmen, menhir. You know, these are Gaelic, sorry, Gaulish words. Now, if I can sort of the main types, we have a dolmen. Okay, now that's usually some upright stones with a large capstone on top, and they sit there on the landscape. The majority of them were once long barrows or multi-chambered tombs. Now, these were built during the Neolithic era, by the people who sort of began to replace the early hunter-gatherers. These were the early farmers, the early pastoralists who came across. They interred their dead or their elite dead inside these long barrows. Now, we call them long barrows because they have this kind of long tapered shape to them. They taper off towards the end, and you have a main entrance at the front. And very often you have side entrances and side chambers as well. Sometimes the front is false. They'll seal it up, and it's a false entrance where they possibly held ceremonies, etc. So that's your long barrows. Now, as time went on, these barrows were, broken into, robbed, dug up, stones pulled away for building, all sorts of things. So what you're left with is the sort of skeleton inside, the dolmen. So you have this huge capstone on top of the uprights. Quite why they use these gigantic capstones inside them, nobody knows. We just don't know. There are examples of dolmens that were freestanding. There was no earth over them. They weren't chambers. These are what we would call placed stones. They very often have a sort of triangular dart shape, appearance to them. And they appear to point towards, celestial objects, the star systems, etc., or points on the landscape. So that's, but those are a very small minority. There are only a few dolmens which you could say were placed there like that. The majority were chambered tombs, sort of long barrows. I've seen examples of them almost broken open, where archaeologists have excavated in sections, and it almost looks like a sort of how a dolmen works in a child's encyclopedia. I've seen some of those in Portugal. They're amazing. You then have your standing stones. Some are on their own. We don't know what they were there for. You would call that a menhir, I guess. Again, it's an old French word, a Gaulish word. It just means a freestanding stone. And we don't know what they were for. They may have been markers, way markers, just the way to somewhere. Ceremonies may have held there. Nobody really knows. And then you have your stone circles. Again, stone circles seem to be concentrated. I mean, in Britain, we have so many of them. When you look across Europe, we've got more than anybody else. Long Barrows and what we call megalithic culture spreads all the way down to Spain. It seems to have originated in Portugal, particularly northern Portugal, and then spread across. But then you've got the sort of south of France and across. I mean, even Japan has dolmens. They made these huge sort of, you know, Russia as well. They have these sort of huge structures with big capstones on where the dead were laid. So the beginnings of it's a huge subject. I mean, I don't want to go into a big sort of history lesson here on it, but those are the sort of the types. I mean, we also have round barrows. You'll see, you'll just call it a barrow. It's a mound. Those are built during the later Bronze Age when the Beaker folk began to come across and replace the people who built the long barrows. Now, they buried their dead basically, and yeah, you just stack them up on branches or whatever, and then just lay them out on top of them. So it's a completely different thing. That there are no chambers. You're not putting people inside chambers. The earlier Neolithic people may have stripped the flesh from the bones of their dead somewhere else, and then placed the bones inside the long barrows and commune with them in some way, but we can't be sure. Another interesting thing that happened was skull stretching, because the Neolithic folk who built the long barrows were enthusiastic practitioners of stretching of skulls. We don't know whether it was just the elite people that had this sort of thing, because we see it all around the world, don't we? Sort of South America, ancient Egypt. I have seen
that, yes.
Yeah, this is something that doesn't get spoken about. Where when the archaeologists go in the sort of early 1800s, they pull them out, all the skulls are noted as being stretched, all of them. It's something that doesn't get talked about. I have heard some of people who are involved in the sort of megalithic community suggest that they were a different race. No, they weren't. They're artificially stretched.
Oh, I see. And, like, they were from another planet or something like that. Yes, this whole Nephilim mystery history. Yeah.
A very well-known person in the megalithic community said, oh, then the Beaker folk came and they had strong, round skulls, different race. And it's, oh, come on.
I see.
That's not why. They just didn't practice skull stretch. Skull stretching went on into the Anglo-Saxon period. It's incredible. Wow. So why, we don't know. Really don't know the purpose of it, whether it was the idea of beauty at the time or... But I'm kind of heading off on one there. Later cultures may have reused earlier structures as, for instance, Wayland Smithy along the Ridgeway. Excellent site, well worth visiting. It's been messed around with a lot and reconstructed and things stood back up again. But you've essentially got yourself a long barrow there. But before that, there was a very, very, very old early Neolithic burial cist with some timber supports around it and then a mound over that. That was extended out into a later Neolithic long barrow. And then you've got Bronze Age people have come along and messed with it as well. And then even after that, the Anglo-Saxons proclaimed it associated with Wayland, the smith, the god of the smithy. So this is very interesting because it's noted on a charter from the 900s. It was known as Welland Smith. So it was important to the Anglo-Saxons too. So you have an example there of a site being reused over generations. You also had the phenomena of Anglo-Saxon saints, or, well, they weren't saints at the time, but we'll say hermits or ascetics, going and living inside long barrows, which is a pretty wild image when you think about it. So you have a guy, you know, St. Guthlac, for instance, of Crowland. The chronicle of his life, where he went to live in a broken long barrow on an island, and he spent weeks fighting off the various demons that live there and assailed him day and night. So that's an interesting thing as well, because the Anglo-Saxons saw barrows, even though they buried their dead in barrows, but they saw the earlier sites as places where the dead lurked, portals to the other world, places to be avoided, basically. Some of the Anglo-Saxon poetry talks about that there's a ghost lurking near a barrow, or that witch wives came riding across the barrows, and this kind of imagery. So they saw them as very foreboding and dark places. It's some of this thing that people will say that, oh, the church renamed them, the church made them evil by calling them the devils this or the devils that. This is nonsense. These names were given to these places by the people, by the folk. These are folk names. So, for instance, you've got the Devil's Den on Fifield Down near the down in Marlborough near Avebury. Now, it wasn't given that name by the church. It was just stories by local folk. Yeah, so there's another myth there that annoys me when I hear it.
And I suppose it would make sense that people living in those local areas, not knowing the history of them, would have their own myths and legends about this place. And those could be influenced by the new religion at the time that they'd all acceded to Christianity. But still, I guess in older times too, people might have had little legends and histories about these places that were made up when they couldn't really uncover the origins of where these mysterious barrows and cromlechs and things like that came from.
The early Anglo-Saxon era was a time of rapid change because they came as pagans, as heathens, and then converted. And there was such an explosion in population, there were various things going on. But there was a phenomenon where they would bury the dead near existing megalithic structures. Now, some have said it was an attempt to gain the protection of whatever supernatural beings may have lived there, but it's more likely to be a way to legitimize their presence there, to say, we're British now, we're English now, we're here. I've seen this in other places. For instance, I'll mention Portugal again, in northern Portugal, I've seen Christian graves carved into the rock very near to a megalithic structure and very near to a dolmen. And it was these were by the Visigoths. Now, the Visigoths were a Germanic tribe similar to the Anglo-Saxons. And that was an attempt to say, we belong here too, because we're near to that ancient structure of the people that went before us. So that's something you'll see.
So in the same way as, I suppose, different tribes and peoples around the world in ancient times have claimed, let's say, a hero like Hercules or Zeus as being their ancestor or their origination point, these guys could have been saying, yes, we're also related to these ancestors that you all acknowledge, and that's why we're putting our graves next to theirs.
Yes, it's possible. I mean, Anglo-Saxon royalty always claimed descent from Woden, the Saxon cognate of Odin. They always did that, even as late as Alfred the Great was a pious Christian, but still claimed descent from Woden. That's just what they did. He was an ancestral deity. It's a big subject, Woden, but we're kind of going off course here.
No, but it's interesting. So I remember this seeing something similar in the Sutton Hoo artifacts, that there was this descent from Woden placed within the grave, but also a descent from the church to say, I'm also carrying on the Christian faith, but I am descended from Woden at the same time. And that was in the 7th century, I think, wasn't it?
Yeah, well, if that really is or was Radwald inside there, which most people think it was, he hedged his bets. He was both a pagan and a Christian because he didn't understand the concept that was being sold to him, that if you convert to Christianity, that's the only god you can have. But he was like, oh, no, that's a nice cross. I'll just put that next to my images of Thor and Woden, etc., in my temple here. So he kind of hedged his bets.
So he was a politician, you.
Yeah, that too. I believe Constantine, the Roman emperor who gave us Christianity as we know it, had a similar approach early on in his time.
Go ahead.
No, I was just going to say, so in the way I'm talking here, you can see how the megaliths, the barrows, they become part of the landscape. They become features in the landscape. They're not going anywhere because they're there forever. They're huge, they're immovable. And so they become a part of the later successive cultures that build their lives around them. And so stories grow around them and they may change the origin of them. They'll tell you, when the Saxons came, for instance, they thought that some of the Roman structures were built by giants.
Wow.
So all these, how on earth could people move such stones? Well, you can if you know what you're doing. But then again, with the Saxons, it was a more cultural thing. They were used to building their houses out of wood and then moving on, you know, where they lived before the migration. So I think they took that practice with them.
And that is very interesting, isn't it, actually, that other cultures, later cultures, come and they take over. And sometimes they're not as technologically advanced in certain aspects as the previous culture, as we saw with the Saxons compared to the Romans. You know, we had underfloor heating and sewerage and medicine and all these different types of things, great farming methods during the Roman period. And then a few hundred years later, you know, we're throwing our waste out of windows into the street for the next, seven or 800 years.
Yes, that's interesting. But it's not all about, it's not saying that one culture was less intelligent than the one before it. They just did things a different way and it suited them. Yeah, the Saxons prior to the migration were used to just moving around the plains and the forests with their herds and just building houses where they went. And then there was war. Obviously, they spent a lot of time at war as well, and fighting. That's one of the reasons they came in the first place. So they just brought that with them and just made it fit into what they found. Obviously, they found England completely covered in forest. Some of it had been cleared, but they set about clearing it because they saw the forest as this almost magical sort of primeval world around them that they didn't trust and they didn't feel safe in. Saxon women would take a bell with them when they went out into the wood to collect things, you know, forage, you know, berries, nuts, etc., and things like that, so that people always knew where they were. They were told to keep ringing it. That's why, you know, the horn was blown before dusk for people to come in. It gave them time to come in time, because they did see the woods as a frightening place.
That is really strange, because, of course, we have these Green Man legends here and these Wood Woes, these Wild Man legends. Could those have come across with the Saxons, or do you think they were already here manifesting within the local cultures?
The Green Man. Wow. that's a huge subject. We first see images of the Green Man after the Anglo-Saxon Age, during the very early Norman occupation of England initially, and then the later Britain. We see these Romanesque churches. Now, Romanesque is my favourite architectural style from history, and it incorporates influences from Anglo-Saxon, Scandinavian, and Celtic even influences. Because if you think about it, if you're building a church in sort of 1080 or 1100, you're still seeing the remains of the Anglo-Saxon civilization all around you, even some of the earlier sort of Brittonic Celtic structures. But they're all long gone now, so we don't see what influenced those sculptors. Now, there was a group of masons, we call them the Herefordshire School, who had travelled. They'd been to Spain, they'd been to southern France, and people were doing these pilgrimages, for example. And you've got the big pilgrimage of St. James, the Santiago de Compostela.
Yeah.
So people were seeing these fantastic structures, these incredible churches, you know, down in Spain and southern France and in Portugal. And so they wanted to replicate that in England. So they built these incredible, carved these incredible images of green men, of warriors, of dragons, snakes, all these things, but taking in the influences of the England that they saw around them. So even though they're creating this church for a Norman lord, he wants it to reflect everything that went before him. So, but this is where we began to see the Green Man during this sort of early Romanesque sculpture era. There seem to be two types. We have the disgorging type, where the foliage is coming out of his mouth and sometimes his nose. And then you have the type where it's just a face set among leaves, commonly referred to as a foliate head. I mean, Green Man was only a name coined much, much, much later on. It was Lady Raglan, I believe, who wrote about it. So we're talking the Victorian era here. That's when the actual term, the Green Man, no one spoke about the Green Man before that. Never mentioned. But let's just call him a green man for, you know, ease of use, shall we say. Now, the disgorging type, who knows? I mean, people have said it's a pagan image, it's a nature god. Come on. No bishop is going to pass off a church that has pagan imagery carved all over it. Why would he? Oh, great, great pagan images there, lads. Keep them coming. You know, that's not going to happen. So we don't understand the early Christian mysticism in England at that time. We don't understand it. It may have taken on elements of the paganism that went before it. Because let's be honest, Anglo-Saxon paganism was probably in the way it was practiced wouldn't have looked all that different to how early Christianity was practiced. Now, I may get neo-pagans exploding when they hear this, but I'm not talking about the deities worshipped or communicated with, but just how it looked, the rituals, the way that the incense, things like that, how it would have worked.
Sure.
Would have been very similar. There would have been a very gradual changeover. You didn't just swipe one away and then replace it with the other. So yes, there may be some lingering imagery from the pagan era, but it wasn't put there to say, here is your pagan god. Hey, look, he's here on this church. Why don't you come on in and take the Lord Jesus Christ as your savior? No, it wasn't that. It was more to say, oh, you had it wrong. That wasn't that God. No, this was just an aspect of Christ, or an aspect of Mary, or an aspect of this saint. That's what that symbol represents.
That's very interesting. Very interesting, because I remember reading a book when I was studying university called A Religion and the Decline of Magic, about how these pagan holy wells and images were slowly transubstantiated, if you like, for Christian imagery, so that the pagan well of, you know, this goddess became, you know, Saint Bridget and so on and so forth, and all of these images were dragged into the church, as you say there, as you mentioned, to sort of reclassify what they meant, and to show the pagans, perhaps, or people who had pagan leanings, that they were a part of God's pantheon and belonged within the church.
Oh, yes. I mean, this was the Roman Catholic Church, and Saint Mary and the saints were revered upon a level with Christ and God, even more so. Now, I can see a clear link with the worship of Mary and the saints, and with possible earlier pagan religions, where you had an earth goddess or an earth mother. The Romans had the Magna Mater, didn't they? And, you know, this huge, you know, statue of a mother figure. That sort of thing. So you can see how Mary was easily kind of slid in there. I think it Ronald Hutton wrote one of his books. I'm trying to remember which one he wrote it in. It may have been in Triumph of the Moon. But he noted, his opinion was that the reason that the Venerable Bede didn't write much about Anglo-Saxon paganism was because it wasn't very different from the incoming Christianity.
Uh-huh.
It looked the same. So he just said the names of the deities, oh, they worship Woden, Thunor, Tyr, you know, and then there's a mention of Eosta for Easter, but there's very little else written. And Hutton theorized that that's because they worship them in exactly the same way as the incoming Christians. There wasn't much difference. The temple looked the same, the inside of it, the procession, the, you know, sermon, if you like, prayers, incense, you know, it was much the same.
And I wonder also if some of the Roman Christianity that had ruled over them during that time period in which the Romans were here, because I know there was a Celtic Christianity before, would have included many of the, you know, the Easter type traditions as well, because of course they would have wanted to inculcate those within the Roman society for the new religion to make it possible.
Yeah,
you know, especially because there's that. Exactly. Yeah, exactly. It's fascinating. It's really fascinating. What about the misery cords? I know that the Green Man is often the misery cords, as well as these carvings that you see here. Yeah, are misery cords only in wood, or are they in stone as well? And why are they so varied? Why are there such a huge variety of images, you know, carved upon benches and walls within the church?
I love Misery Courts. I love them. It just means mercy, and the word. And what they were put in for, you obviously all of our cathedrals in England and, well, throughout the wider Britain, but mostly England, they were monasteries, obviously, before the Reformation.
Yes.
So you had these old monks, and you know, some of these guys were in their 80s. Monks were required to stand throughout services. They couldn't sit down or sit after the prayer. They had to stand or kneel. So these old guys are getting pretty tired. So this little hatch was put in that would fold down that he could kind of put his butt on and lean against. And it was a mercy. That's what Misericords were put in for.
Ah.
So, that's the sole reason. So the old monks could just lean against them, basically, when they're tired throughout the service. Now, it became a very popular little device to put in churches. The idea was taken into other places, but that's how they began, and that's what the word means. It means a mercy. So, but the reason they're so ornate, I think the guy's just given the job to do, and he's going to do it properly. They wanted everything in that cathedral to look, to just tell you about the aspects of God, spirituality. Spirituality was everything. Everything around you was God. Every blade of grass, every atom of air, of oxygen, it was the word of God around you, which goes back to Green Men a little bit. I had a conversation with the vicar in the church at Avebury. So you got a church almost in the middle of a stone circle there. Now, she was talking about the Green Man, saying that her theory was that when people are out in the fields, they're working, as most people did, they were rustics, it was to remind them that the word of God is all around them. That the nature, the foliage spewing from the mouth, it's reminding him that, there's the word of God. There it is. It's just all around you. It's constantly spewing forth. That's one theory. The other theory was it's to do with Adam's son, Seth, taking seeds from his mouth, and which became, I think it was the Moses' burning bush. So that was a popular story. That was a popular Jewish story, which was going around in the early medieval era. So there's another theory that it does relate to that. I really don't think the Green Man is as pagan as people think. But going back to the Misery Courts and the sort of, you'll see some fantastic examples. Worcester Cathedral has some amazing ones, and there's a pair of Green Men on there. Also got the clever farmer's daughter, the story of the clever farmer's daughter sandwiched between the Green Men. In there, I think they're just purely decorative. But I've seen some incredible ones because you've got, for instance, they'll often go over the seasons. And so each Misery Court will represent a month in the year and the work that would go on in the seasons. And it's reminding people of all the work that was going on. So you'll see images of pigs eating acorns, they're being fattened. And then you see the next Misery Court, you see the poor thing being dragged off. And then the next one is in pieces on her table. And it has been butchered throughout the winter, and it's showing what happens throughout the various things. Now, there's an interesting thing which some people might say was a pagan throwback. There's a church, there's a village called Ripple in Worcestershire. They have a magnificent church there. It's huge. There was once a monastery there. Their Misery Courts, they have a, in the middle, you've got this image of the Lady of the Fields. Now, some would say that's a pagan thing. There you go. People still had that thing, the Lady of the Fields. Well, maybe it was once, but it was an aspect of Mary because you still see it today. If you go to Portugal, or say again, to Spain, Italy, they have their Lady of the Fields festival. It's just another aspect of Mary. Because Mary seems to be this kind of, ubiquitous sort of deity which can cover everything. You've got Our Lady of Pain, Our Lady of the Sea, Our Lady of, everything. They're just aspects of Mary. Again, you can see a link to the past there before Christianity, possibly. But you've got this carving of the Lady of the Fields, but it is Mary. It was carved there purely in a Christian context. Now, there may be a vestigial, how can I put it, ancestral memory, perhaps, where this is what we have always done. We've always made an offering to the lady of the field. That's what we call her. But when that thing was carved, it was carved in a Christian context. It's a very big subject, this. It really is, because you're talking about what these images mean to people. An image can evoke a feeling in a person, and they don't understand what that feeling is. Like for instance, people will talk about some of our folk festivals. You've got things like Garland Day in Castleton in the Peak District, where you've got this fellow completely head to toe in flowers. He can't see who's going hardly. It's like a cone of flowers on a horse, and he's got a lady with him, but the same kind of thing. And they go around the town, and then they end up at the church. And this thing is hoisted off his head, and it's put up to the church roof. Now, people have said this is a pagan practice, and others have said nonsense. They just started doing it in the late 1700s. It was a guilds. Okay, while they're doing it, they might not be forming a pagan ritual, but the reasons why people want to do it may harken back to some kind of ancestral consciousness, you know, some kind of drive to want to make an offering to nature or to a central places of worship, such as the church.
That's interesting.
Hope that makes sense when I'm kind of saying that.
No, it makes perfect sense. And I mean, really, just thinking about it, and it does seem that these days we're far too eager to excuse all of the things from our history as being Christian rip-offs of previous societies. And perhaps they're a little more closely intertwined than we believe. And the Christian aspect of it, as you say, coming from this architectural discipline that was inherited from Portugal and the continent after the Norman period, could explain a lot of what we later came to view as ripoffs of early pagan and Celtic cultures, whereas actually it was the church saying, yes, this does harken back to something a long time ago, but really it's a Catholic tradition of, you know, universal inculcation of all of the deities of the old pagan gods repackaged within the Christian faith and then exported to us here on the island, you know. And
that's a good way of thinking about it. Have you ever been to Kilpeck in Herefordshire and seen the church there?
I haven't. No, I haven't. Well, but I have been to Santiago de Compostela in Galicia. And,
really?
Yes, and I do remember seeing some of the images there and wondering about the similarities between some of our churches back here, at least some aspects of them.
Yeah, yeah. One day I'll walk. It's the Camino. That's the word I was searching for earlier. Yeah, the Camino de Santiago. The journey, the way of
the pilgrimage.
One day I'll walk some of that.
Wow, good luck. It's apparent it's great fun. People do really get a lot of camaraderie out of it. I went by car. I was traveling across northern Spain, and I stopped off, and we drove the whole way there. We didn't walk any single thing. We walked into the church, if that helps. But that was about it.
Wow. I had a bizarre encounter with somebody walking the Camino while in Portugal. I was with my good lady. We were investigating a dolmen. And this one was still within its mound. It had been cut away and excavated. And it was a pretty cool little thing. It was one circular chamber. Anyway, but it's in a thick eucalyptus forest. There's nobody about. All you can hear is birds singing and things. It's a very hot day. And then turn around, and there's a lady walking towards us with a backpack on. And turned out she was German, and she was asking for directions. And she was on the Camino. And there was nobody about for miles. And somehow she found her way to that site, to this old dolmen where we were, and asked for directions. Offered her a lift, and she refused because she said, no, you got to walk it. So,
wow.
Very, that was a very odd encounter, that one. Yeah. But
But I do love the German people, but I do really respect their ability to keep a calm head when in strange situations. And she was probably obviously hopelessly lost, but seemed completely calm and composed to you, right? But the rest of us would be flipping out. You know, I'm in the middle of a forest. There's some strange people here. Hopefully I can find my way back 20 miles to the road of whatever it was, right?
But yeah, going back
Germans.
To
yeah.
We were Green Man, Misericords, and Paganism and Christianity.
Mm.
Yeah, so just to say that Christianity, it did not just say, oh, you know, this is the new thing, it's the same thing, but the new thing. It's not like that. I think for the common folk, it was just a gradual change. It was a much more gradual change. Yeah, they went to church because that's the custom now. Okay, that's what they did. They pray to Mary, they pray to Christ, they pray to their saints, because people like to work through intercessors. They didn't pray directly to God. In the Catholic faith, people tend to pray to Mary or to a saint. They don't always pray directly to God or to Christ. I mean they will, but that's much more common. So when you go to some of the Mediterranean countries. And you'll see this, all these candles and, you know, dedicated to these various saints. And they're the same for everything, the thing that you're asking for. They like to work through intercessors. And I think that's what people did in pre-Christian times, in the pagan religions, rather than, oh, I call on Odin to, you know, bless my efforts to build this house. I think they would more work with a smaller spirit, a spirit of the place. Yeah, like the Romans did. So it's an interesting thing. It's an interesting subject. It's possible that some of these symbols that we see on churches, that we put down to pagan symbols, they may be intercessors that people look towards and pray towards, like, you know, go between them and God. There's that as well. I said Kilpec because that's the sort of, you know, the master class, the tour de force. The mystical Romanesque carving, and it's in such fantastic condition. The doorway is incredible. It's got Nordic looking warriors. It's got a snake shedding its skin. It's got a disgorging green man. It's got, I mean, a snake shedding its skin is a big clue there to, you know, it's saying shed off your old self and become a Christian. And there's a tree of life at the top, which people have said, oh, look, it's Yggdrasil. It's Nordic. No, it's not. Because the tree of life meant the growth of your faith throughout your life and how the tree of Christianity remains constant. It's always there. It grows and grows throughout the world.
Well, I was going to say, it's also about immortality, isn't it? Because what happens when we exit the Garden of Eden, we're no longer immortal. We can no longer eat from the tree of life. But the promise is with Christianity, you will eat from the tree of life again and live forever. So there it is at the top, after you shed off your sinful serpent like you know, skin, there's that tree at the top to which you will once again have access, so to speak.
And it's just to comment before we kind of move on this, there's a tendency within the pagan community to discount everything Christian, say, oh, rubbish, you know, Christian invention, that. But if you want to learn about the paganism of our ancestors, then learn about Christianity, because one became the other.
You know what? I think that's really good advice. And we are living in an age of cultural revisionism at the moment, in which many philosophies and theories seem to be subject to people's philosophy. You know, the philosophy is it's almost domineering what we believe about what happened in the past. And I personally, you know, I try to extricate myself from that and see the plain facts as far as I can outside of my personal desires and philosophy of what I would like it to be, or how I would like it to reinforce my beliefs or opinions or religious, you know, ideology. And it's hard to do it because, you know, our preference is, has a very strong, control over our actions and our desires.
Yeah, I agree. I do agree with that.
Let's talk about Sorry, I keep talking over you here, and I'm terrible for it, but I'm very excited about what you're telling me, and I think this is why I keep jumping on top of you. So I apologize for that.
That's fine.
You talked about this crossover Christianity and paganism, and it reminded me of some of the old churches and churchyards and cathedrals and even castles being haunted, with these spirits. Every single one of them seems to have some kind of haunting spirit. And that doesn't seem to really be a part of Christianity, because you die and you go to that waiting place until the judgment. You don't come back. So why do you think there's such a belief about ghosts and spirits in graveyards and in castles and things like that?
We don't want to accept that that's the end, that death is the end. We like to think that we're going to go on in some way. And now, whether that means inhabiting heaven or being reincarnated, or people just want to believe that there's more to it. There's more to life than death. There's more to death than life. That there are spirits, and there's a chance that the dead are out there walking around. It's become such a big part of our culture, of our very lives. I mean, ghosts have always been believed in. I think the Epic of Gilgamesh actually has an encounter with a ghost in it. So people have believed in ghosts through every phase of every religion throughout history. It's never gone away. It's always going to be there. Now, obviously, each successive culture puts its own sort of take on it, its own filter, and shapes how we see things. The Victorians had their seances and table knocking and ectoplasm. Now, today, you'll go to a visit a medium, and they'll say, "Oh, is there a John here?" And he's tapping his head. What does that mean? And he wants you to know that, he had things to say before he went. Does that make
Exactly.
sense to you? All that rubbish. But you can see how it changes through time, how we shape it culturally. The ghost will always be here. It's just what we like. Okay, so someone is walking through a ruined castle, just sitting there, and they see a strange shadow, and they think, "Oh, knights used to walk about in here, or ladies in flowing robes and conical hats, and it must be one of them." I mean, I'm not discounting the existence of ghosts, because I've had some supernatural experiences. That's all I can say. I'm not saying that I saw a ghost, because I don't really know what happened. I've had unexplainable experiences, shall we say. I mean, in any old building, you're going to get creaking and groaning and various noises. You're going to get that. Ask anybody who works in a historic pub, and they'll tell you about all the sounds and noises. But then again, there are unexplainable things. I mean, pubs are a different thing, because the sheer volume of people going in and out of them. And if you've got a pub from the 1600s, you think of all those people that have gone through that, and all those people that have been under the influence of alcohol. Now, I'm possibly opening up a whole other topic here, but alcohol is seen as a demon in some cultures, and I'm kind of inclined to agree. I mean, even the word alcohol it's an Arabic demon, and it's said that when you're drunk, you're letting these things in. And some believe that that's why people behave like such idiots when they're drunk. You've got that demon on your back forever, alcoholism, etc. Now, you think about all of those people under the influence of alcohol, thousands and thousands, even a million possibly, through the centuries have lived there. There's going to be some residual energy. So that may explain what we know as ghosts, but I don't think it's a ghost of a particular person. I think it's just activity, phenomena, something. But then again, one could say that it's one particular spirit that has set itself up as the, how can I say, the intercessor between those that went before and us. I mean, people talk about demonic energy, and I have to choose my words carefully here. I can agree with that to a certain extent, that there are balls, if you like, or clusters of energy floating around the world that they're not human, they're not animal, they're not really of this world. They're very difficult to understand, and they can only be described as demons. And they behave in certain ways. They may attach themselves to a person, or they may just hover in an area, and they'll be known as a ghost then. Oh, I don't know if that makes any sense, Andy.
No, I've heard of this actually, and it's almost as a sort of an imitation or a mimicry of a living person by a demonic force that undertakes some activities or some route that the person would have taken, or even some interactions that the person would have had in order to deceive the living as to the nature of the dead. So that's something I've definitely come across. I've also come across stuff like the stone tape theory, where people are saying some of these old buildings almost, you know, replicate in certain environments the function of a camera and record events happening, or certain people walking certain routes. And when those atmospheric conditions are recreated within, you know, the camera, that is the stone edifice of the building, that they're repeated, replayed almost like a projector. Well, what do you think about that?
Yes, an interesting subject. However, there's not a lot in it. Stone tape theory was put forward by a gentleman called T.C. Lethbridge. Hmm. Now, old T.C., he did a lot of work. He was an interesting character. He was an early Fortean researcher, if you like. He believed there was a lot more on this world than we think, and he was off, you know, doing various work. For instance, the Gog Magog Hills, I think it's Oxfordshire, is it? He believed, or he mapped out some old sort of chalk figures of a deity pulling a chariot, and then a deity with a dog behind it, and then something else holding the sword. And he believed that they'd been carved onto that, but it's been rubbished. He was just seeing random patterns on the hillside in the chalk. It was just that they weren't people. But I'm just saying that it was old TC invented the stone tape theory, and the idea that stones could hold some kind of energy or some kind of memory within them. Now, people have run with this idea and said that quartz, possibly, and also iron fibers within the rock, ferrite, can hold memories. And they then said that cassette tapes can hold the memory as well. Well, because you record onto a cassette tape, and that cassette tape has minerals, doesn't it, pressed into its, you know, into the ribbon of the tape.
Yes,
there's a very thin layer of minerals in it. I'm not sure of the exact makeup without checking of those minerals.
Yeah, I don't know. No,
they
don't
say
know
that that's how the recording happens. Now, there used to be a thing back in, I don't know how old you are, but I'm old enough to remember when, if you, anywhere you were walking past a hedge or something, you'd very often see a cassette tape completely unspooled and just tangled all around. Yes. the hedge. You'd see that a lot when we were kids. Now, we used to say that, we were told that Satanists and various pagans of a more dark bent would record a warning or a curse onto this cassette tape. Then they'd unspool the cassette tape, and then they'd wrap it round the area they didn't want you to go in as a barrier.
Okay.
Yeah, it's
that's
interesting,
what
isn't
that
it?
Was.
That one. Yeah, well, I'm not saying that's what it was in every case, because a lot of times you were just in the car, oh, God, it's tangled, and they threw it out the car.
Yeah, somebody's Walkman spilled their tape and they threw it away. Yeah, exactly.
But
yeah,
sometimes you would see it deliberately stretched across an opening.
Yeah.
Have you ever seen the film The Borderlands?
No.
Andy, you've got to see it. It's fantastic. It's a English folk horror movie about these fellas who are investigating a haunted church. And whether a miracle that happened there is real. And they talk about that because they come across it and again, someone's done it there. And he mentioned it and it reminded me when I saw it. But that's, yeah, stone tape. But also, have you seen the television drama, The Stone Tape?
No, I haven't.
You still haven't watched it? It's on YouTube.
No,
it's out
I will.
There.
I will.
It's very of its time. It's very 70s, and you wouldn't get away with some of the things that, were said now. However, it's fantastic, and it really goes with this idea. They're basically inventing a new recording medium, and they've discovered that these rocks, these stones inside this old house or this old castle are recording memories.
Okay.
They accidentally, and as they strip the place away, they discover there are these layers and layers and layers. And right at the very bottom of it are these, we're going back to the start of the conversation, megaliths. There were these old structures right within the place. Yeah. And there are things that come out that are not human. That we talk about the demonic energy, that they're primeval. They can't be named.
That's
they can't be described. Yeah.
I'll definitely have to put it on the list and watch it. And
it's dated. It's of its time, you know, but
I don't mind that.
Great.
I'm a child of the 70s. I don't mind that at all, actually.
Well, it's a must.
Absolutely. And I prefer older films these days. I think it's, like you say, the age thing. When I want to see something I can relate to, you know,
yes.
I prefer going back a little ways, maybe a little too far back. And it's something, there's something comforting about it that's lacking sorely. And I'm sure all people feel, I'm sure our grandparents felt that in the 60s and 70s when they're reviewing films from the 30s. And it's what you relate to in a way, isn't it?
You talk about the stones. If you're relating it to megaliths, I'm not so sure that they were used for anything like that.
No.
Some people say they do. But I will say this. If you keep doing something over, over, over and over, some kind of ritual, then you're going to imprint some kind of energy onto the thing you're doing it in. Like a church, for instance, it's had services held there for over and over. That energy is going to stay there for a very long time after the church has been decommissioned. So you've got places like, for instance, the Rolls-Royce Stones. You're familiar with that place. Well, the Rolls-Royce Stones is almost the perfect circle. You know, not quite, because time goes on, but it's virtually a perfect circle. So it's ideal for rituals carried out by modern neo-pagans. Now, various energies have been imprinted on it. So you've got people doing various things. During the 70s and sort of early 80s, there were all sorts of things going on at the Rolls-Royce at night time, to the point where it almost became a mini festival at times, the amount of people that were heading down there in vans and hippies, etc. But people will imprint these various things. Now, my feeling at the Rolls-Royce is I don't feel anything there at all. It feels to me like a dead battery, like an empty vessel. It's devoid of all energy and atmosphere. And my feeling is that many people have been doing things there over the centuries, over the millennia even, that they've all cancelled each other out almost.
Oh, it's become they've such worn it a down. Mishmash. They've worn it out.
Exactly. Worn it out. Yeah, it won't hold a charge anymore. That's how I see it. The Rolls-Royce are interesting because you had Anglo-Saxons burials there. You had Roman remains. There was all sorts of stuff going on there. It was only sort of revived, as I say, by Stukeley and Co. And then John Michel. And then through the 70s, you had William Gray and various people were doing things there. The Rolls-Royce ritual. There's so much going on. And there's an underground military bunker underneath the Rolls-Royce stones, which people don't realize. Now, that sounds like a bonkers conspiracy theory, but it's absolutely true. It was a listening post. Yeah, the Royal Observer Corps during the war had a little shed and a little setup there looking out for German bombers. And they decided, they then built a little bunker underground and then it went down. Then it became a listening post during the Cold War. It's still there, but it's been filled up with concrete, so you can't get in it. It's just interesting. It adds yet another layer of mystery and weirdness at the Rolls-Royce. It's an interesting place. Yeah.
These things, they seem to be all over the country. And I've recently been recording a TV series called Weird Britain, and we've been going around the various counties of England and also to Wales and Scotland, etc. And you find these things everywhere. And one of the things that first, I suppose, put me onto you was this book, which I don't have yet. I am going to buy it, which is this about Mercia, you know, stories of Mercia. I started to think to myself, where was Mercia then? And what was the country like at the time that that region existed with that name? And you know, what were some of the stories associated with that place?
Well, the reason for the mystery of Mercia is Mercia, that's a Latinization of the Anglo-Saxon name, but it means the borderlands. It means the borders, the borderlands. Okay. Now it gets reproduced in different languages, in French, etc. For instance, the borderland between England and Wales is known as the Marches, as you may be aware.
So that comes
from Mercia. Okay. And then we get Marquis, Marchionessy, different. So Mercia was bordered on all sides, and it was known as the Borderlands. And that got me thinking, the Borderlands. When you're out, when you're visiting mysterious places, when you're walking a lonely landscape, you're almost in a liminal space. You're in a borderland between times, between cultures, between energies. There are some forests. I realize that even though our most ancient forests have still been managed and worked to a certain extent, there's no tree that you'll see today that was there in AD 600. However, that path had been walked by people, you know, thousands of years before you. There's nobody about. You are seeing the same things that they saw. You're smelling the same things. You're hearing the same things. If you're on a lonely moor out in the Pennines or the Peak District, and you can't see a single house, telegraph pole, anything, you're seeing a view that people would have seen 1,000 years previously. So you're almost stepping back. You're crossing the border, and you're going almost into a different state. You're smelling the same things. You're hearing the same things as them. You're going back in time. So you're walking this borderland, and that's what gave me the idea to let's walk this borderland, let's walk the line, the liminal space between things. You know, if you look at, we were talking about the Green Man earlier on. If you look at some sort of Romanesque imagery on a church, and you're staring at our symbol, and it's evoking feeling, a sensation inside you, you're feeling the same thing that someone would have thought in 1100. So you've crossed that line, you've gone across. When you hear a folk tale associated with a dolmen, oh, the devil would drink water out of it, you know, every at dawn, and oh, you've just gone back to the same sensation that someone hearing that story in 1650 would have felt. So you've gone into that strange land, the uncanny valley, where anything can happen. So that's how I see Mercia in that sense. And that's what gave me the idea for the mystery of Mercia. We keep walking. And my philosophy has always been enjoy the mystery. Don't investigate it too much. I mean, yeah, investigate if that's your thing. But let's not be too clinical about things. Where's our sense of wonder? What happened to that? Because a sense of wonder, it's not childish. It's childlike, and that's a different thing. There was nothing wrong with you know, having a sense of wonder, seeing the nature, the things around you, looking at a set of megaliths and think, God, these look fantastic. Looking up at a medieval church with an incredible tower, thinking that's incredible. Having that sense of wonder, we need that. It's becoming a cliche phrase now, but re-enchanting the land. That's what I'm trying to do. I'm trying to encourage my readers to see the land as, let's go out there and re-enchant it. Let's have our sense of wonder as we walk, and let's see it as a more magical place than others may have us. Because that's what our ancestor did. They did see it as a kind of mystical place, if you like. Not always in a good way, you know, because they had no control over things. People wanted control over their lives. And they didn't really have any. If you're a rustic, you're an agricultural worker in 1610, you have very little control over your own life, because you're at the mercy of the weather, You don't know what the weather's going to do. It could ruin everything you've done. Politics, you have no control over that. You couldn't vote. Only landowners could vote then in Parliament. Yeah, you had no control over your life. So people would turn to their sort of folk practices that people today call paganism, but they were more, you know, folk practices, trying to talk through an intercessor towards the divine to try and grant them a wish or grant them some luck over something that they're doing, to give them a sense of control that they are doing something to take control of an aspect of their lives. So that's why you'll often see these marks on churches that we call witch marks. And a lot of times these are people just trying to make a union between them and the divine that they weren't getting from the church service. The church service is just a sermon, prayer, communion, and off you go. So they wanted something more. They wanted something personal. And they got that through making these marks on churches. You see the VV, the Great Virgin, the Virgin of Virgins. But very often people would do that to appeal to Mary. It's an interesting thing. So I'm not quite sure how I started on that sort of talk, but I'm talking about the liminal space and how I see Mercia, how I see it as a place that we should be regarding with a sense of wonder. Let's not go to, obviously that's not a cat, that's this or that. Well, let's just let it be. Let the mystery be. Let's be a bit more agnostic about things. Is that a good way of putting it?
Yeah, I suppose so. And you know, in the in one of those old famous Aesop's fables, you know, when they took that golden goose apart to get at what was inside, they ruined that magical, wonderful thing, didn't they? So sometimes,
yes,
perhaps you're right, uncovering the mystery of how things really came about, or how things worked, or at least picking it apart to its very bare bones, destroys the sense of wonder attached to it. And I think that's a good philosophy. I was up at Loch Ness in the late summer last year, part of that big expedition. And one of the questions that kept coming up constantly was, what happens after they find the monster, if there is a monster there, what happens after they find it? And somebody mentioned then it just becomes like another animal, like the giant squid, the kraken, you know, defrocked, as it were, is just a giant squid. And when you see a giant squid in some museum, in some, you know, formaldehyde or something, it's amazing, but it's just a giant squid. And, you know, 100 or so years ago, that was the kraken from the deep, this mysterious monster that sailed ships, or, you know, lonely oarsmen out there fishing on the seas. And yet, when defrocked, it really holds no wonder at all anymore. It's just this creature that lives somewhere that we know about. And I wonder if that's the same for all of
that's
these
a
mysteries.
Great observation. That's a great observation, Andy. And you're quite right. If they found a Bigfoot, if they shot Bigfoot, captured Bigfoot, okay, now what? Okay, Bigfoot, that means that every sighting was just somebody looking at this animal, which we now know what it was. And like you say, if you found Nessie, okay, that means everything before was just somebody looking at Nessie. It's no longer the paranormal. It's no longer the weird, the 14. It's just somebody saw this Nessieopolis, you know, whatever Latin terminology they'll give to her when they find her. So I agree. Let's have a bit more of the mystery. I mean what happened to weird was a phrase bandied around a while ago. Why are we so atheistic about our mysteries? Why do we look at some of the recent things with UFOs or UAPs, as they're called now? It's this, it's a military thing, it's this or that. And nobody cares. I mean, if aliens appeared in the skies today and wanted to talk to people, I don't think anybody would be shocked.
You're right. Yeah, I do.
And they wouldn't care. They'd be going, well, that's all very well, but, you know, there's a war in Ukraine and there's this or that. And, you know, there's so many things going on. I think in older times, people didn't have the mindset that we have today. Our minds are completely crowded with information, most of which we don't need, most of which are about things that we can't change or do anything about. And we're bombarded with media, social media. People waste their time. So much of their time is on there. But our ancestors didn't have this. All they had to do was just do their work for the day and make sure they could eat and make sure that roof was over their heads. So they had a lot more time to wander. And they had different fears. And so I think it's within our psyche to wonder about things. So why fight it? Why push it out? I think you'll have a bit more of a enjoyable time of it while you're out walking or exploring if you just keep that sense of wonder, that keep that sense of agnosticism about things. That's how I see it anyway, and that's what started me off on the mystery of Mercia. The magic of Mercia, my third book, is a different thing altogether, because that's a history of witchcraft in the Midlands, but that it's related, so that's why we kept the Mercia title. That's a different thing altogether. I just wanted to write an accessible history of witchcraft in the Midlands, because the Midlands doesn't get celebrated enough. We hear a lot about weird Yorkshire, weird Cornwall, or the witch hunts of East Anglia, the witch hunts of the North Pendle Hill, etc. But we don't hear enough about the Midlands. So I wanted to do something to rectify that. So that's what my project has been so far.
And it really does. And I think that's why I was so attracted to it, basically, because you don't often hear about the Midlands, and especially not in the form of Mercia. That really hit home to me. I thought, yeah, this is something that I've got to find out about. It's been fantastic and amazing. I think we're definitely going to have an interview too at some point in the future, and perhaps we'll leave it there for now. But just for everybody that's listening out there, just let them know where they can get the book and how they can support you in what you do.
Okay. Mysteriesofmercia.com. That's my website. You can purchase my book. I archive all of my articles on there. And you can sign up to be a subscriber, and you'll know when something new arrives on the site. On Facebook, you can find me, Hugh Williams, author, it comes under Mysteries of Mercia. So again, just type in Mysteries of Mercia. You'll see my author page, and you'll see there's a group where people can share their own strange stories or strange places of the Midlands as well. So there you go.
I think it sounds fantastic, wonderful. I recommend everybody out there runs out immediately and buys that book. I'm definitely going to buy it today, just after we finish this conversation. And it's been wonderful having you on. Thank you so much.
Thank you so much, Andy. It's been great. I really enjoyed that. Thank you.